Welcome to the South Carolina State Library's podcast, Library Voices SC. I'm Curtis Rogers, Communications Director, and today I'm pleased to have with us in our studio Dr. Catherine Reynolds Chaddick. She's the author of Uncompromising Activist, Richard Greener, First Black Graduate of Harvard College, and it was published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And Dr. Chaddick is Distinguished Professor Emerita of Education at the University of South Carolina, and she's also the author of The Multi-Talented Mr. Erskine, Shaping Mass Culture Through Great Books and Fine Music, and Visions and Vanities, John Andrew Rice of Black Mountain College. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. I had remembered seeing in the Free Times newspaper about this book, and it immediately piqued my interest.
It's wonderful.
Just one of those really neat things. And so we actually didn't have a copy of the book in our collection, but now we do.
Wonderful.
So we're good. So just as part of the conversation, what got you interested in Richard Greener, and what kind of drew you to the topic? And maybe just tell us a little bit about him.
Well, it's been a bit of a journey. About 8 or 9 years ago, I was teaching a course in history of higher education, and I had probably mentioned Greener to my students. All I knew about him was that he was indeed the first black professor at the University of South Carolina, mm-hmm. and I knew his name, and almost nothing else. I may have known that he was the first black graduate of Harvard College, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. At any rate, that semester, I had a trip to Boston for a conference, and I decided I wanted to go to the Harvard bookstore and check it out. When I got off the underground and walked across the street, there was on one of the buildings a big plaque to Richard Greener. And I went, oh my gosh. And it was a wordy plaque. It had about 200 words on him, and is the fact that he was their first black graduate at Harvard, but also said a few things about his mom and dad, and his dad was lost in the gold rush when Greener was about 8. His mom and Greener were in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was not born in Cambridge. He was born in Philadelphia. They moved up there, and he went to elementary school there, but then had to quit and have a job. This plaque was very detailed, so I went back to my students and said, hey, I guess I should have said more about Richard Greener, and here's what happened in Boston and so forth. And together we decided, well, why don't we have anything on campus at University of South Carolina about him? Mm-hmm. Why does nobody know who he is, et cetera, et cetera? So we got together, got some other faculty members, some deans, some alums, some staff members, and formed a committee, the Richard Greener Memorial Planning Committee, and started planning and thinking of what to do on campus. Eventually that evolved into doing a statue, which will soon happen on campus. It actually is in bronze now and will arrive on campus either late 2017 or early 2018. There'll be a ceremony, a dedication, an unveiling, and so forth, date to be determined, but in the not too distant future. So that's all started about 8 years ago. And during that process, people were saying, you know, you write biography. Maybe you should do a biography of him and blah, blah, blah. I said, no. I'm doing all these other things, and I'm going to retire eventually and so forth. But then the more I got to know about him through the statue project, the more interesting he became. And it was almost impossible not to want to do a biography of him. There had been in 2002 a dissertation by Michael Mounter in the history department.
At USC?
At USC, about Greener. And I even talked to Michael Mounter. It became apparent he wasn't going to take it any further. His his Greener days were over, and, as happens with dissertations. And so then I thought, well, if he's not going to, somebody should. I guess maybe it will be me. And that's how it happened. By that time, I knew that he was also the first black diplomat to a white country. I knew that he had been the executive director of the Grant Monument Commission in New York City, et cetera, et cetera. But I learned a lot more as I was researching the biography.
Right. Well, you know, as I looked through the book and did a little bit more research on my own, he was the first of a lot of things, but specifically related to libraries, which really, really piqued my interest, is that he was the first Black librarian at the University of South Carolina. And I just want to read real quickly, because looking about how it all came about. Here it is on page 61. Greener found that many books were misclassified and inaccurately shelved due to Everson, and that was the previous librarian, due to Everson's ignorance of Greek, Latin, or French. I just thought that was great. So he stepped in and he was able to take over.
Greener was a good scholar. And when Everson kind of disappeared in the night, this the previous librarian, he sort of said, hey, I want to go over there and see what's going on, and looked around and went, oh, this place could be reorganized. We could get a card catalog. We could do everything. And so he took a real interest in that, and he was well-versed in Latin, Greek, and French. Actually, he had a benefactor when he was growing up in Cambridge. He met a couple of people. One was George Herbert Palmer, and another one was Augustus Batchelder. They saw to it that he went to Oberlin. He went to Oberlin for a year in Ohio, and then he went to Andover. He was the only Black at Andover at that time, at Andover Academy. And then he went to Harvard. Then he was sort of prepared to actually take the entrance test to Harvard. Mm-hmm. And got to Harvard, and after Harvard, of course, things weren't easy for him. I mean, Harvard opened doors for people who were white, but people who were Black were, you know, still not able to get the kind of jobs and so forth that others did. Mm-hmm. He was teaching in a high school in Philadelphia, became an assistant principal. This is about, he had been there maybe 3 years when somebody, and we never really have discovered who, somebody put the bug in somebody's ears at the University of South Carolina, which had just integrated its student body. Mm-hmm. And during Reconstruction in the early 1870s, and somebody told them about Greener and the fact that he could teach everything from Latin to philosophy to history, et cetera, et cetera. And they approached him and said, hey, would you come down here and be a professor for us? Mm-hmm. This was a time when the university, of course, since they had decided to integrate, and the legislature was very integrated, and a lot of students and faculty left and because they didn't want to teach the Black population in 1870, or they didn't want to learn with them. So it was an interesting time for the university, and it was a wonderful opening for Greener. He loved his experience in South Carolina. He was only here about 4 years before Reconstruction ended, and the university closed for a while and then went back to all white. Mm-hmm. But he ever after called himself a South Carolinian.
Really?
Yes.
How neat. And didn't he live on campus?
Yes, he did. He lived at what is now Lieber House. And that sort of was, at that time, really like a duplex, side-by-side faculty residences in one building. Mm-hmm. And so there was another gentleman, really top scholar, who had come out of Yale, who was on the other side. And Greener thought, this is fantastic. Somebody's willing to, you know, live in the same building that a Black person lives on the other side? Because that had not, before Reconstruction, that wasn't happening that much.
Yeah. I mean, this is South Carolina in the 1870s we're talking about.
So he had a wonderful run on campus. And, you know, you mentioned his firsts. I guess what I really liked finding out was he was more than the sum of his firsts. Mm-hmm. He did an enormous amount of speaking, politicking, et cetera, for the cause of racial equality and for those politicians who believed in racial equality to get them elected and so forth and so on. He spoke widely. He wrote widely about it, and he campaigned widely. so he was he became very well known. He became very well known, and he was an eloquent speaker, so mm-hmm. that helped too.
Well, in the book, there's a the portrait of him, and he looks quite distinguished.
Yes, and I think he liked looking distinguished. There are some old photos and so forth, and he's always looking ramrod straight and very conscious of, you know, people, what people thought about the African American population and what, you know, being sort of better than what people typically thought about the African American population. He was very conscious of that. He had very light skin for a black, and that was sort of a problem. He was often found to be, by fellow blacks, too light-skinned for their taste. Mm. They'd suspect him of maybe trying to pass mm-hmm. as white or getting too cozy with the whites. I mean, he had this white education, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So it was kind of, but then being actually known as an African-American person, he also sometimes had problems with the whites. Mm-hmm. So he sort of was in a bit of a complicated never-never land in his personal and professional life.
Sure, yeah, that can be, I imagine at that time, was, you know, extremely difficult. Also, I remember seeing somewhere that there is a scholarship in his name at the University of South Carolina.
There is. There are people called Greener Scholars. Okay. Oh, that person's a Greener Scholar. And every year, that group inducts a new scholar or more. And so, yes, that's been a good thing for the university. But oddly enough, I mean, I didn't even hear about the Greener Scholars and their undergrads mm-hmm. until I was, guess I was, you know, researching Greener for the statue and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so even with that scholarship, which is a wonderful thing, and people, you know, some people at least knowing about it, Greener was not well known on campus by the time I got there in 1994.
Yeah, like I said, I'd never heard his name and or seen his name, and when I saw the article in the Free Times, which is our local alternative newspaper here in Columbia, South Carolina, I thought this is really something that people need to know about because he was evidently quite an extraordinary individual.
He was, and he accomplished quite a bit. He spent, let's see, after, it was a little tough for him immediately after his stint at the University of South Carolina. The late 1870s, he went back up to New York. I mean, I'm sorry, Washington, D.C. His wife was from Washington, D.C. She was also very light-skinned. They had started having children. Mm-hmm. And he was able to get a job in the federal government. It was actually integrated at that time, mm-hmm. the federal workforce. And while he did that, he eventually became an instructor at Howard Law School. Mm-hmm. While he was in Columbia, he had also gotten he was a faculty member, a librarian, and also got a law degree at the university in the integrated law school. Uh-huh. So he started working for Howard University. He eventually became the dean of the Howard University Law School in wow. Washington, D.C. for a fairly short time. Mm-hmm. They were struggling. That law school was struggling at the time, and they eventually regrouped and so forth. But he was able to do that, and then he also at the same time started his own law practice. Mm. One of his most memorable legal cases had to do with one of his students at University of South Carolina, a student who later became a cadet at West Point. Mm. And he was found actually sort of tied up and beat up one night, mm-hmm. and just months before graduation, mm-hmm. this student, his name was Whitaker, and he immediately went into some kind of, you know, court-martial situation where people at West Point decided he had lied. He had tied himself up and beat himself up. Mm. That it really wasn't white guys in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. He was the only black cadet on campus at that time. but he talked to Greener about it and actually hired Greener as his lawyer.
Wow.
And Greener was at the court-martial and wanted it to go to a court-martial because that took it a little bit more out of the academy and into the legal system. They lost the case, but they did win that a lesser charge that he didn't really tie himself up and beat himself up. He actually simply lied about it or something. Slightly lesser charge, but he never got to graduate from West Point. Eventually, the Department of Defense, Robert Lincoln was the Secretary of Defense at the time, did exonerate him. And eventually, he got posthumously from Bill Clinton his commission as a graduating cadet at West Point.
Gosh.
But Greener did lose that case. But he had other, law practice. His cases were interesting to him. But shortly after that, in the 1880s, he became the executive director of the Grant Monument Commission. He was the only paid staff member. It was a big board under Mayor Grace and so forth.
Sure.
But he really was raising the funds and doing the things it took for that. He was there about 6 or 7 years. And then eventually he became a campaigner for William McKinley and his run for president. And when he became president, he appointed Greener to be a diplomat to Vladivostok, Russia.
That's just amazing because, there's this Chapter 11 is called Our Man in Vladivostok. And you think, how in the world did all that come about?
You just don't picture it either. Vladivostok, though, was a very international city. Okay. Chinese, Japanese, Russian. Mm-hmm. The Siberian Railroad had just been completed and so forth. And so it was a heady time for Greener. He was the first one, the first American to raise a diplomatic flag for the United States in Vladivostok, because we had not had a presence there before, but it was becoming more and more important. And so that was a good time for him. Unfortunately, his marriage kind of fell apart when he left for Vladivostok. They didn't want the children and the mother did not want to go, and the marriage was kind of falling apart while they were in New York for the Monument Commission. So he went. He never saw that family again.
Really?
Five children and a wife. They changed their name and passed for white and just slipped past the color line.
You're kidding.
Which was actually great for them. The sons and daughters got to go to schools they never would have gotten to go to. The daughter went to teacher's college at Columbia. A son graduated from New York University, and then in about 1913 graduated with a master's from University of Tennessee, which certainly wasn't admitting black people. But they didn't know. They didn't know. And so actually Greener had a second family then. In Vladivostok, he met a Japanese lady. And had three children with that second family. But then when Teddy Roosevelt came in and he got recalled, that was the end. He thought he would get back to that part of the world, but he never did. He was a little naive. The diplomatic corps was totally political at that point.
Sure.
So McKinley had appointed him. Now Roosevelt had people he owed things to and so forth. So he wasn't going to just reappoint McKinley appointees. That was their time was up. So he never got back to that family either.
That's fascinating. Well, one of the things that that I think is important to mention and discuss is, how did you come up with uncompromising activist? How did that end up being the title?
That wasn't actually my title,
and I yeah, a lot of times it is the press or the publisher.
My title was more emphasizing the dilemma of a light-skinned, kind of white-educated black person. My suggested title was Between a Black and a White Place, : Richard Greener and the Politics of Equality. But the press that publishes the book are in charge
of this. They have the choice.
They, came up with a couple of titles that I didn't like so well, and I said, no, no, no. I don't even want Harvard in the title. That's mm-hmm. one chapter in the book.
Sure.
And so forth. But, oh, they said, but this is a great marketing hook, and I guess that's their concern is not just the title,
right,
they
want to sell
the book.
Exactly.
And you sort of, well, that's fine. And oddly enough, I saw when I was going over the book one final time before, you know, it was going to be printed and so forth, I found that in some chapter I had called another black activist, I actually think it was Frederick Douglass, but somebody else that Greener associated with, mm-hmm. I had called that person an uncompromising activist.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh my gosh, we can't call another person this when we've hung it on Greener for the book title.
Right.
And so I took that out in reference to, it was either him or Greener knew W.E.B. Du Bois, mm-hmm. Booker Washington, Frederick Douglass. I mean, those people all hung together somewhat. They didn't always agree, but they, you know, they... Mm-hmm. They hung together as far as caring about the black population.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things you've got here. Chapter 7 is unsettled advocate. What's the story behind that? What was he an advocate of and for?
That really referred to his law career.
Mm-hmm.
And he it was unsettling because as far as a black lawyer hanging out a shingle,
mm-hmm.
you're going to get mostly African Americans at that time, you know, hiring you mm-hmm. for their attorney.
Right.
And there were as many cases that were very unsettling, like the Whitaker case at West Point, because they couldn't be won, perhaps largely because they were a case of somebody who was African American.
Mm.
Then there were other cases that shouldn't be won because they, you know, somebody really did do something wrong,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. So it was a struggle for Greener to reconcile those kinds of things, the cases that couldn't be won and the cases that he defended but shouldn't be won and so forth and so on. So that his lawyering
mm-hmm.
Really pretty much ended, although I'm sure he used, you know, what he knew of the law in many other ways.
Sure.
But it really pretty much ended really by the early 1880s or mid-1880s.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, he ended up dying in 1922?
Yes.
Wow,
yes.
What a long life.
He had an interesting last 15 years or so. He came back from Vladivostok and went through San Francisco in 1906, just as the earthquake hit San Francisco.
Oh, jeez.
And so that sort of was an omen
mm-hmm.
of things to come, which were he really didn't know where he wanted to settle. The Jim Crow South had gotten so Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
Lynchings had grown, you know, murders, et cetera, of all kinds. Discrimination had grown rather than shrunk,
mm-hmm.
whereas he had been an activist for ending all that.
Right.
You know, it was very discouraging. He ended up going to Chicago. He visited South Carolina a couple of times in 1907, 1908,
mm-hmm.
and visited on campus mm-hmm. at the time at University of South Carolina. He went into the library, which at that time was what we now call South Carolina Library.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't tell them that he was black. An assistant librarian asked him, oh, well, you know, da-da-da, and you da-da-da, and he just said, oh, yes, I worked here many years ago, and left it at that. He was afraid he'd get kicked off this all-white campus
sure.
that he used to work on, but then he had some distant relatives in Chicago. He visited them. He moved in with them. There were three sort of old maid sisters.
Mm-hmm.
He had been really friendly with the mother. One of the sisters was the first black female lawyer in Illinois.
Wow.
The first that was a bar member in mm-hmm. Illinois. Anyway, he lived with them from 1907 to 1922. They were near the University of Chicago. He would go they'd let him take out books at the University of Chicago since he was a former university librarian.
That's
he
great.
Got kind of professional
special
courtesy.
Dispensation.
Yes. He did some traveling. He went to his Andover, you know, reunion. He went to speaking engagements. He traveled to the Niagara meeting that W.E.D. Du Bois held and so forth, but it was always sort of among people who knew who he was, there was always sort of a myth that he lost everything really he had of any value and documents and so forth in the San Francisco earthquake and came back with nothing. But then about, you know, now about 5 years ago, all that was found in a trunk in Chicago, a hundred and some years later. And his law license, his South Carolina law license, his South Carolina law diploma from the law school, his Harvard diploma was in there, and a bunch of books and so forth. South Carolina Library and the library in general at the university did buy back the things pertinent to them. And eventually the Harvard diploma, Harvard decided not to buy it back, but it went to auction, and somehow it's ended up at Harvard anyway.
Okay.
So whatever. But yeah, so he's a complicated person. His ins and outs about his family life, about his light skin, dark, you know, dark skin, light skin kind of things are fascinating. And even his varied careers and how he, you know, sort of got into one and out of another and started doing this and that. And a very fascinating, complicated person, and by no means perfect either. I mean, he was, of course, he was smart. He was, some people saw him as pushy. And some people saw him as sort of self-aggrandizing.
Sure.
I think he probably had to be a little bit pushy and self-aggrandizing to get anywhere.
Right.
But, you know, he, very, very complicated person. He did an excellent job at the University of South Carolina. He personally went to the legislature and got money for scholarships for poor people, two from every county.
Wow.
There were 34 counties, I think, then. And mostly those were poor African Americans. But those scholarships stayed on the books for many years after the university closed to African Americans. And so they helped the poor white people later. And he also, you know, did get money to renovate the library. And he got money for a preparatory program, because even with the scholarship money, there weren't enough African Americans that could qualify to come and pass an entrance exam. So he ran a preparatory program for them. And so, yeah, it's kind of neat when somebody is a lot of firsts, but it's also wonderfully neat when they accomplish a lot.
It really is. And it's really nice to see that that the University of South Carolina is putting this rather large statue near the Thomas Cooper Library.
Absolutely.
So that's going to be a great tribute to him.
It will be awesome. There is no other named statue on campus. The only other named statue is George Rogers down at the football stadium.
Okay.
So he will be the first statue of an actually named person, you know, in Memorial II. And it happens at a time when so many places are contentious about statues and statues coming down.
Exactly.
So we're putting one up.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Again, this is uncompromising activist Richard Greener, first black graduate of Harvard College. And we've been talking with Dr. Catherine Reynolds Chaddick. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.